Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the House of Pod.
My name is Kaveh Hoda. I think I'm saying that correctly. I am the host of this medical humorish sort of podcasty thing that you're listening to. Sorry. I have an interesting show today. I'm so glad you're all here to hear it and to share this with me. There's two guests that have not been on the show before. I'm excited to have them both on. I've interacted with them both a ton on social media, but I have not, as of yet, met them in the Zoom space, at least. Let's start with Dr. Solman Aziz Mirza, the most Persian-sounding name for a non-Persian doctor in the history of doctors. Dr. Mirza, how are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. I have a six-day-old baby that's, you know, supposed to be asleep right now, but it's wanting some milk. But, you know, we're dealing with that. We're working with that. So thanks, Kaveh. Hopefully I said that the right way. And is that a name that you picked up along the way? Or
it's really Bob. Oh. And I just thought, what would be better for radio? Bob or a name that no one can pronounce?
So you need the uniqueness. You got to stand out.
What, a six day old baby?
I know.
You doing okay?
We tried to plan it.
You holding up?
You know, it's weird because I've shifted my sleep schedule now to kind of be like, I'm trying to give my wife the nights off to try to sleep off through the night. Yeah. But now I'm awake during the night, so I was like, oh, you know, this would be great. I'll do 11 p.m. Eastern time, standard time. We'll record this, and the baby's not cooperating, of course. So you know, we're making it work. No. They never play along.
Can I ask you? Is this your first?
This is not my first. This is number four. So, okay. Oh my goodness. This
so that's
is
why.
Terrible life decisions. Yeah.
No. Hey, listen, man, you know, the world must be peopled and it might as well be from you. So that's great, man. Congrats. Mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you. Buongiorno. Buongiorno.
Yeah, exactly. Prego. Ragu. And tell the good people, the good listeners, what you do.
Yeah. So I am a psychiatrist. I'm one of those people who, during their doctor colleging, was like, you know what? I don't want to touch people. I don't want to touch human bodies. I just want to sit across the room from them and just like chit chat here and there. So I was like, what's a better job than psychiatry? I thought it was super fascinating, really interesting. So that's what got me into it. I about over 5 years out of my residency and my fellowship, I'm in Northern Virginia, do some work with the health system over here, working with mostly kids and adolescents. So I love child adolescent psychiatry work. I have a practice working with adults. I do a lot of stuff in addiction. And I do some stuff with the National Basketball Players Association. Not my favorite basketball team, the Wizards, but I work, you know what? I mean, the Wizards, that's who I work with. ideally, I'd love to be out with you guys on the West Coast with my favorite team. You know, we have a common love of the Warriors, and
that's right.
I feel like I could really help out Draymond and his certain fascination he has for punching people below the belt. But
I would love that. I would love to do it. Actually, just let's bookmark this for a future NBA episode. I'm serious. Yeah, I had Rick Barry on the show, actually. That was interesting. Yeah. So I'd love to get you on to do that. We'll get to that. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. We have a very different subject today, which is, I think, equally fascinating. Joining us to help with this conversation is a second-year medical student. I'm not going to give you his real name. I'm going to give you his nom de guerre. I say that wrong, apparently. People ridicule me for it. But I'll give you his pseudonym, which is Bone Wizard. Bone. I'm just gonna call you Bone or that Bony works. Or some variation of Bone.
I've got every variation at this point.
First, for people who are relatively new to the show and haven't heard when I've had guests on that don't want to use their real name, like doctors or student doctors, such as Bone Wizard here, can you briefly explain to people why it is that someone at your stage of your career would not want to use their real name? Because some people are listening right now and like, I don't understand. Why won't he say his real name? You know, Jack Smith. I just said your real name. I'm so sorry. I'll edit that out.
Don't worry. No, the real white name.
You were John Doe. No.
Yeah, there we go.
So you tell people why, first of all, you wouldn't want to use it.
Yeah. So, I guess one of the biggest things, because when I first started Twitter, which is where that name came from, it was during the middle of, so I'm a second year, right? So it's been 2 years ago when I started med school. We had the pandemic with the MCAT going on, the medical school test, and they canceled a bunch on us. And in a fit of I want to burn the world down around me, I made a fake Twitter account and started making memes. And I also started sending free resources for people to not have to pay for things with the AMC makes them pay for. And eventually I got blocked by the MCAT Twitter because I annoyed them so much with my bot that I made to send free resources. So that's where that started. And then I realized that with my like name being anonymous, I could do a lot more with advocacy and organization things. And, and it just cascaded from there. And then it doesn't backfire on me as badly when a physician or someone higher than me, someone that's doctor, MDDO, whatever, anything higher than a med student, which is just about everything, gets upset with what I say. They can't find me, and they've tried. And I've had doctors that have been very upset with me because I've said, hey, abortion is healthcare. And then they didn't like that. And they tried to find me and hunt me down and have found me sometimes. And I'm like, ooh, you got a little too close. So, sometimes people are a little vindictive online and, I got to protect yourself.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. I totally understand. I'm glad you explained it so well. And you're in your second year of medical school and you are interested in psychiatry, in particular forensic psychiatry. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Can you tell people what forensic psychiatry is?
Well, I'm not the psychiatrist here, but I can give you a bit of introduction or a brief bit of what I know about it.
So, I'm not either, just in case anyone wants to know. That is not me either. But go on.
And Solomon can correct me, obviously. But from what I understand, from what I know, it's that it's the branch of psychiatry that tends to work with criminals in the criminal justice system, people that are, on trial, people that are, between trials, whatever, in order to dictate, their level of competency, their level of fitness to stand trial. And as well as being expert witnesses to cases, like I know the one that I work with, I shadow of forensics, and she often works with the FBI and gets called in on expert witness cases in order to do anything from competency all the way through just being able to give a profile. So,
Okay, that's a good nutshell. So the reason that, plays into today's topic is we are going to discuss serial killers. It was an idea you actually brought up, Bone, so thanks for doing that, and I appreciate you.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that, and I have questions I think that I would love to hear both of you guys weigh in on. Dr. Mirza, we're obviously going to rely on your expertise in psychiatry here to help us with some some basic terms. Oh, before I forget, though,
we're in trouble.
Because I know they would love to have their name associated with serial killers, this episode is being brought to you by Lucky Dog Hot Sauce. All of today's contestants will go home with a case of Lucky Dog Hot Sauce, my personal favorite hot sauce. I can't recommend it enough. Get it, try it, you'll love it. Find them at luckydoghotsauce.com. When you think Lucky Dog Hot Sauce, think serial killers. That's what I want the listeners to go home with. Let's start, Dr. Mirza, with just some basic terminology, okay? When we talk about serial killers and we talk about them in popular culture, the terms sociopath and psychopath come up a lot, sometimes interchangeably. Can you define what these terms mean and what might be more appropriate in this setting of discussion of serial killers?
Yeah, it's interesting because psychopathy, sociopathy, again, these terms have been used interchangeably for a long time. And they came out of kind of different origins in different places. Originally, the word psychopath was there that people were having kind of these behaviors that were not along with society. They were antisocial behaviors, emotional detachment, things along those lines. And then there was this kind of shift that happened a few decades ago. Well, not a few decades ago, about 100 years ago, where there was this idea that saying the constant kind of argument of nature versus nurture. And when people were originally using the word psychopath, that's where it was that nature part. People were born evil, they were born a certain way, and they were going to have these kind of antisocial behaviors. And then when there was this more of this kind of shift towards saying, well, let's start looking at the environment, let's start looking at things and during the behaviorism, that's where the word sociopath came about, where they're saying, well, I think these behaviors are a product of society and the environment around them. However, the main thing is that the word sociopath has recently, maybe about since, you know, the 60s and onwards, has been essentially taken out of psychiatry and psychology as a whole. So we don't use sociopath anymore. If you go into DSM-5 and beyond, or even before then, the word sociopath isn't there. Because there has been this, as we've done more research and as if we learned more, we've done more kind of like brain imaging, etc., we've seen that there isn't really a difference. I mean, you know, there is these people who have the psychopathic traits. We know that there is a psychopath scale that's out there, psychopathy scale that's out there that people can use to kind of rate somebody's level of psychopathy. So we've kind of not used this, and we've understand that now that there is this kind of meld between the biological factors, the psychosocial factors, and the social factors that are there that create these kind of people who have these behaviors.
Is there a new nomenclature that we should be using when describing this? I mean, when you're describing to another psychiatrist, someone with the behaviors we're going to talk about, what terms would you give them? How would you describe them? What terminology would you use?
Yeah, so we use the word psychopath. That's the one we use. We don't use sociopath anymore. And the things that we're looking for, even if we're looking at it from personality disorder point of view, would be things like the most kind of equivalent diagnosis would be the antisocial personality disorder. And those kind of behaviors that are associated with that are things like disregard of the law, a lot of lying, cheating, stealing. So kind of like one of my wrestling heroes, Eddie Guerrero, rest in peace, lie, cheat, and steal to win. Those are kind of things that are there. Being impulsive, you know, failing to plan ahead, acting irresponsibly consistently, easily provoked, angry, these kind of things. And the biggest things are things like lack of remorse, and lack of connection, lack of kind of expected normal pro-social behaviors and emotions.
You know, it's funny to me because I had heard that about the term sociopath falling out of vogue, but it still feels like psychopath is a loaded word as well. And it feels like one of these words that, like, I have a hard time imagining a medical professional using. You know, I mean, I'm assuming it's used exceedingly rarely.
Yeah, I think if we look at the data, we're looking at, you know, less than 2% of the overall population, more closer to 1% of the population would fit somebody for antisocial personality disorder or potentially even psychopathy. Sociopath is softer, right? Again, like there's a lot of words like in medicine that when we look at them, when we use them, you know, we use the word retardation, you know, for all kinds of things, right? And it comes across so poorly when other people hear it. They're like, oh my God, you use the word retardation. Yeah. It's like, no, it doesn't mean that. Like, growth retardation just means you haven't grown as much, right? And this is the limits of my like medical, you know, body medicine kind of knowledge. But you know, we use these kind of words that have these meanings that are there. Yeah. But psychopath is the word, sociopath is the word that's colloquially out there. And psychiatry is really interesting with mental health, is that there's so many words that have kind of crossed over to like everyday language that are being used incorrectly all the time. We hear it all the time. The weather's so bipolar, you're acting so OCD, like what is depression? Everything is trauma nowadays. Again, these words are being thrown around and they've lost meaning essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really good point. Okay, so talking about serial killers, I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on this. And Bone, I'll let you start first. I don't know if it's a resurgence in the last 10 years or if it's always been there, but all you have to do is look at Netflix and there's like no less than 3 Dahmer movies or documentaries. There's like 2 John Wayne Gacy and 2 Ted Bundy things that show up just from the briefest glance. I guess my first question is, why do serial killers fascinate us so much? One, is it an American thing? And 2, just in general, why do they fascinate us as humans?
So it's funny because I was at a lunch with a professor and my classmates like a couple weeks ago. And me and another guy who were both interested in psychiatry started just gossiping and talking about just like, literally just table talk serial killers. And it's just because it's, at least for me and someone who's within forensics, it's the idea of why somebody would do this to someone else. There are so many examples throughout history. I mean, you could look on like the list of serial killers on Wikipedia, and it's in the 200s plus of the people they know. And most of them, they don't know the names of, they just know there are bodies associated and they don't know who. But for most people, it's a kind of a gross morbidity, I guess. It's kind of like it's like watching a train wreck where you're like, oh, I don't want to look away, but it's going to be really horrible when it hits.
Yeah.
But for me specifically, it's that it's the why does this happen and why can't we stop them? Like, why can't we, you know, I guess we'll talk about this later, but why can't we fix this right now? Like, we don't have enough information to know how to fix this, like fix these people before they get to this point. And if they get to this point, we don't know how to fix them from there. You know, it's not something we know how to do yet. And that's just what's super fascinating to me. But I think a lot of people, it is definitely that morbid fascination, because a lot of people won't want to watch, you know, Silence of the Lambs followed by, you know, some other horror movie after another, because it's too real for them. But for me, it's like, this is just obviously not a real depiction of you know, what we're talking about, but it's that intrigue into why the brain works that way. And as far as American thing goes, like maybe, obviously I'm American. I'm as white as the day is long.
No,
I know that.
Don't say that about yourself.
No, you came into this call and I'm like, oh, you guys are both the most Persian people. And I'm like, ooh, I'm white.
I couldn't tell. I thought that was a filter. I didn't think that white. I thought it was like a ghost filter. Here. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
But I know that the list of serial killers, like if you look at, you know, where they've been, it's not an American thing to have serial killers. It's just an American thing to be, to have knowledge of the discrete knowledge of them. Like, we know that they are in other countries. Like, you know, Jack the Ripper is a really famous case that's in London, and that's one of the oldest ones we have. But if you look, you can look at like the ones that are in India and China, Russia. They don't get caught because they don't have the level of, you know, I say a lot about our police force, but we do have a big police force. We have a militarized police force. Yeah.
My question is, though, is the fascination with serial killers an American thing, or is that more universal?
I think it's American, but I also can't say for sure. We do have the highest amount of these, like, you know, serial killer documentaries, these, you know, and there's like the one with Casey Anthony just came out too. I mean, not even serial killers, but just murderers in general. We have a fascination with the murderer mind, you know.
Solomon, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily just an American thing. I think we have, as a humanity, like a fascination with that. Like, we can go back to like Freud stuff, you know, and we'll get our cigars and our glasses and our lines of cocaine out, mm-hmm. when we're talking about Freud. But like, you know, he had this concept of people having these drives in life, right? That there's the sex drive, the what's it called, Eros, and that, which is, you know, the drive towards life, and commonly we call it like libido Thanatos. Nowadays. Yeah, and then right, then the opposite of that is Thanatos, which is the drive to death, which, you know, we call nowadays Marvel has, you know, used Thanatos to Thanos to be making, you know, snapping away half of the galaxy, right? And that's kind of that idea is, you know, when we really, really read it and look at into it, is that while there is a drive to life, there's also that drive for death, and we want it. We kind of, that's a goal of life, is the ultimate of death, or we know that it ends in death. So there is a fascination with it. There's an unconscious kind of like pull towards it that's there. And I think also we kind of like what Bowen was saying was that when we're looking at these documentaries, we also want to know and say, you know, how do we protect ourselves? So it is that kind of survival instinct, sure. in a way, kind of kick in, yeah. to be like, oh my God, this can happen to me. And what can I do to avoid this happening to me as much as possible? And how can we learn from these people? How can we study these people so that, again, this doesn't happen to myself? So there's that aspect of it as well.
I was gonna say the thing I know too from, you know, my classes in psychology and stuff like that, which again don't have the expertise that Solman has, but it's the call of the void is one of those big things that we see in philosophy and psychology too, is that, you know, that thing everybody has is like, where you're driving down the road and you're like, ooh, I could just turn the wheel and go into the ditch. You're like, well, why don't I do that? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's just the same level of why does the brain do with what the brain does, and why can someone go this far into doing something so horrible that we see, you know, and the victims could be in the 30s to hundreds sort of thing. So
yeah, that's true. I think a lot of people probably at some point heard some voice in their head that's like, ooh, why don't you just see what it would be like to jump off that building? But luckily, for the most part, there's this other voice in their heads that are like, stop, that would be counterproductive. So we're lucky with that. And getting back to something you said, Solman, like you know, it is interesting. That's one of my excuses for watching these films too, like these documentary movies about serial killers, is I want to be like, okay, how can I learn? What do I learn to like look for, to watch out for? But I think the reality of it is that a lot of us like to be scared. We experience the adrenaline, endorphin rush, and we feel it in fear, but in a controlled way that's not actually dangerous, and we like it. But a question I have is, when people are watching these things, when people are drawn to serial killers, I'm wondering, is it because what the serial killers are doing is so foreign and so bizarre and so outside of the realm of the normal? Or is it because they kind of understand and they're kind of like, that person, that little sick voice in my head says to do this. That's interesting to see someone doing that. That's kind of what worries me a little bit, you know?
Yeah, that's the other thing, is like, it is that double aspect of it, right? When we watch scary movies, we play violent video games. Like, again, like I love, you know, I always say this all the time, Mortal Kombat's my favorite video game series. I've been ripping heads off and hearts out and all that stuff for decades, 3 decades plus now. But I don't do that in my real life, right? So I'm able to do that in, you know, I do that in the video games, hopefully, right? Or at least I'm not telling anybody about it.
Right.
But, you know, we do that out there. So we do it on the screen so that we can get that out almost, so we can kind of indulge that fantasies that may be there, right? There's that aspect where we have anger, frustration, you know, and we don't act on these things. We may have the thoughts there. You know, I was even just driving today, like some kid was driving around and cut me off, and I had my, you know, my other kids in the back of the minivan, and I pulled up and I rolled down the window and I was like yelling at the guy. And I was like, afterwards, I was like, man, I acted out on that. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. It could have been a bad situation.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been, who knows if like he could have, you know, pulled a gun out of me or done X, Y, and Z. But like, you know, a lot of times we don't do something. Again, that voice in our head tells us, don't do this. So when we watch these, you know, movies, like, you know, horror movies, go on roller coasters, watch documentaries, it is kind of really indulging that aspect of it, living that out almost a little bit.
Yeah.
Then also, you know, being in the safety of like, you know, I'm in my bed and I'm in my house, I'm in my couch, I'm watching this, and I'm safe. I can get that danger without actually being in danger.
Yeah. Right.
Well, so, I always think about it, how interesting it was that the Dexter TV show, it's one of my favorite TV shows of all time, but it's how famous it was and how popular it was for being, you know, almost, it's a vigilantism, but it was also a serial killer who, you know, had a ritual. He had, you know, he had a thing. He had a whole thing he did every single time he killed someone. And it was just a thing we watched. We all watched that for 9 seasons. You know, it was 18.
Well, come on. I stopped after like season 1 or 2 because all of us watched
9 seasons. Yeah. I devoured that.
I dipped out after, I think, season 4 or 5. Then I was done.
Wow. Not really true fans here, guys.
No.
It got real bad. It got pretty bad.
It did get bad, and it got better, and then it got better again. But there was a bad bit, yeah. But and it's interesting too, because like there was a serial killer who used the crimes of Dexter to do his crimes. So you know, we've had this media, you know, for the longest time, and it's been popular media too. Like Dexter was popular in almost most crowds, widespread enough for that it had a resurgence season later too. So it's definitely media we've all consumed. I don't know whether or not it's sublimation or if it's just the way that we just don't want to go and act off our thoughts, you know.
So you mentioned something interesting there. You talked about the ritual. Can you explain a little bit about what that means? I mean, is this something that is a part of serial killers as we know them? I'm sure not every serial killer, but is this part of how we define a serial killer, like the ritual like they have? Like for Dexter, it was like he like, I can't remember, like he duct taped them down or something.
Cleanliness thing.
Yeah. So is the ritual part of it?
So I guess, you know, obviously, Solomon, please cut in if I say something wrong, but serial killing itself is going to be the, you know, 3 or more separate instances of killing, is, you know, 1 or more people, right? But the instance of rituals, though, so an article I found was that almost 97% 95% of cases of serial killing have some manner of ritual, and ritual is only going to be thing. I think it's like, mutilation beyond like the normal amount of what you need to kill someone, torture, going back after the crime and doing something with the body. So really what it is there's something on the crime scene that is unnecessary for the homicide, versus like a signature, which is something else that the FBI has identified as a distinct or unique behavior, not seen at any time or any other time or any other crime scene, you know, in that vicinity, right? And so the FBI found that they called it calling cards, which is really cliche, I guess, or maybe we took the term later and made that popular. You know, this is the 1980s when they figured this out. But they said almost in 95% of cases, there's at least some instance of an extra, beyond the homicide, something else going on. There was a study that said it had 90 plus offenders with 5 plus crimes, or 5 plus murders. And it said like 73% had disfigurement, you know, 84% had necrophilia, 86% torture, blah, blah, blah. So like there was a lot, you know, it's not something that's in every case, but it's a lot of them.
When you look at the stories and you look at the other signifying features of serial killers, what is the thing that is, when they describe the people, what are the common running themes? I mean, if we were to believe what I see on Netflix, it's all quiet white dudes. Is that pretty accurate?
It is remarkably accurate, at least for American serial killers. For other countries, it depends. Obviously, you're not going to have the quiet white guy, you know, in India, but you're going to have that same level of kind of unassuming nature. A lot of the time when you see these, the commonalities tend to be like a person that has some ability to be glib, which is like, you know, being, I guess, lying with a straight face, right? Being able to lie with a straight face, kind of being able to kind of put on a mask. But it is a lot of time. It is just the quiet white guy that you know, you're like, oh, I wouldn't have known it was him. Like, I mean, off the top of my head, like Ted Bundy wasn't, you know, he was really charismatic. Dennis Rader had kids and a wife.
Who's that? I'm not familiar with that one. Who's that?
Dennis Rader is the bind, torture, kill killer.
BTK guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, John Wayne Gacy, just named 3 big ones. He also had a wife, and I think he had a kid. I can't remember now off the top of my head, but I know he had a wife. And he was pretty popular in, you know, in the local politics too. So they do, they are tend to be overwhelmingly white and male. Female serial killers are very rare. And they tend to be a very different MO and a very different like set of situations going on.
Let's segue here into some listener questions, because I have more questions that relate to this, but I think they're covered in some of these listener questions. So I think we should start getting to them. Let's start with one from Judy Melanick, Dr. Judy Melanick at Twitter. If you don't know who she is, she's an amazing author. Her and her husband write these great medical mystery novels. But here's one that we'll get into something I want to discuss, which is, can you explain how to determine if someone is competent to stand trial? And this is a question, Solomon, that I think a lot of us probably have. It was like, by definition, if you're doing these things that these guys have done, it's almost like they have to be insane, right? How could they not? So how is that determined in a court of law?
It's a great question. And it's something that's like really commonly mistaken, even within the hospital system. You know, when as psychiatrists, one of the number one questions that we get is, oh, can you assess somebody for competency? And then we always say, do you mean capacity, right? So there's that aspect, all right? Yeah. So competency is a legal term. Capacity is a medical term. And when we talk about competency to stand trial, it's pretty simple in a way. The definition of it, there's two things that need to be met, essentially. One is that the person understands the charges. And two, they have an understanding of the procedures that are going on against them. And that's really it for competency to stand trial. So that's what we're really looking for. So then what the job of like a forensic psychologist, psychiatrist, someone in the forensic field is to say, or even just like a regular jury or a regular judge and jury is to say, is a person competent to stand trial? Are they able to understand what's, again, the charges, what will happen to them, and the procedure of the court's proceedings?
So how does that affect, I mean, I know we're getting into legal aspects here that probably no one here is really equipped to answer, but we're always under the assumption in popular culture that if you plead insane, you have a much better chance of not being put to death. You're going to go maybe to like a cushy, quote unquote, like mental institution, some more nicer than say like Folsom Prison or something like that. In reality, how does it change? How does it make a difference in where the, how their court trial goes and how their sentencing goes?
And this comes down really state by state. When we talk about NGRIs, not guilty by reason of insanity, or somebody pleading the insanity defense, it really comes down to, again, state by state and what the laws are over there. Majority of the time, you know, and I got into a fight with a old friend of mine. She's a lawyer slash model, not really doing much of the lawyering. And that's maybe why we got into this fight about it. But she was, I think she was saying something about like, about after, unfortunately, one of these like mass shootings occurring, and made a Facebook comment of like, oh my God, I can't believe these people are psychotic and doing these things, saying these kind of comments. So I was like, you're a lawyer, you know that it's not psychotic. That's not the term that we use for these kind of things. You know, we can say that it's terrible and it's X, Y, and Z, but it's not psychotic. So when we talk about competency and psychosis and not guilty by reason of insanity, these kind of things, we're really looking to see, again, at the time that the incident, whatever the alleged crime occurred, did the person have a full sense?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
What was going on around them. I've worked like in, you know, during residency training, like in forensic prisons, worked with people who've murdered their families, murdered other people. And they oftentimes will have some history of psychotic mental illness, things like schizophrenia, or they'll have a major depressive episode and they'll have a psychotic break at the moment, anything along those lines. Mm-hmm. That's what you're really trying to kind of say, hey, is there a history to support this? This is where, again, the forensic psychiatrists, psychologists are making their money, is really sitting down or putting out these reports to say, there's a history of this happening. People, witnesses who were there, could have, you know, their statements that were being made to kind of prove or to say that the person was probably not in a normal state of mind and a quote unquote within their senses at the time of the crime occurring.
Have you ever seen a case where somebody has been otherwise unremarkable, no past medical history, no criminal history, has one moment of intense, horrible, horrific violence, and then it seems to just go away? Is that ever the case, or is there always have to, we're talking in absolute terms that are, you know, impossible to do, but can you see that, or do you normally have to have some history behind it?
Most of the time, most of the people that I've like run into or had experiences with, like, they've had a history of something or other for a while. And then, you know, they've made statements or they'll keep coming back when they're referencing whatever happened to them. There is that break from the reality that's there. We had a guy who was in the VA hospital, and I'll change some details to kind of protect HIPAA and all that stuff, was like, he had essentially like murdered his brother because he was convinced that he was stealing some bodily fluids from him. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, the murder happened, you know, again, decades ago, but he would still kind of reference it like to this day or to that day, that like it was a common thing that's happening. He's like, watch out for my brother, he's stealing these things from me, man. And, you know, it's again this break that's there to kind of say like, this guy's not all right, you know, stuff is going on. That's, you know, these are the people that are going to end up in those state psychiatric hospitals. People are going to be not guilty by reason of insanity are the people that have, again, these momentary breaks that are there, and then they have these episodes of rage. Sure, right? So that can happen. And a lot of times that's going to really depend on, you know, for that person who doesn't have the history to kind of quote unquote get off or to be ruled not guilty of reason of insanity, witnesses that need to be there to kind of corroborate that. Because otherwise, then, you know, we've had the people who always cry for those. Again, I think it was the Batman shooter, the guy in the movie theater. Mm-hmm, he was claiming he was insane, and that what got thrown out. So people who, when they claim this, again, it's not always successful. The success rate for people who are trying to get off by not by NGRI status is really, really, is pretty low.
Yeah, I should mention, you've said this before, I believe, in some of your TikToks, that people with a history of mental illness are much more likely to be harmed physically than to harm someone physically. I think we probably should mention that. I think that's hopefully well known at this point, but looking at some of the, because Bowen, I know you've been researching a lot of these cases here, looking at some of the diagnoses they've been given, do we have access to what diagnoses some of these serial killers have been given?
So the thing is a lot of these don't get, I mean, that's a lot of medical information that we don't get. However, unless they're, you know, obviously they're not guilty by reason of insanity, the only one that I know of, that I think a lot of people might know of, is Ed Gein, serial killer from like the 1906. If I can make this really quick, like the TLDR, that you didn't read, is that the movie American Chainsaw is based off of him, and so is Psycho.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre, young man, know your history. This is important for American. American, you think, American Horror Story, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
My bad.
American Psycho. We're getting everything mixed up.
I think I thought American Psycho at the same time. My bad. Yeah, that's a good movie,
blur.
Too.
It's all blur. Yeah.
Anyway, so he killed his brother his mother possibly, and then a woman in the town, and also in the town that he was in, and then, you know, was just grave robbing, cutting up bits and pieces off people, using them to make lampshades, to make, you know, just the most grotesque things. But he was found not guilty by reason of insanity because of his diagnosis of schizophrenia. So that was what got him off, more or less. But it's mostly because, I mean, what Solomon was saying is that he didn't know what, he wasn't okay, right? That he wasn't okay. I mean, obviously what he did was horrific, but he wasn't okay. And he needed to get real help for that. So that's the only one I know of off the top of my head that is tried and true, like that was insanity, not reason insanity. A lot of serial killers that we've had, you know, the access to, like the information, they don't have a lot of diagnoses. I mean, they have obviously psychopathy, you know, antisocial personality disorder, but they don't have things that would be critical to be saying that person is not guilty by reason of insanity, like Solomon was saying. It often doesn't happen. Like, I mean, Ted Bundy, you know, he didn't have anything in his history. You know, they went through his history. They didn't have anything. The biggest thing that you could look and point at and be like, hey, this is a big thing, was that his when he was born out of wedlock, his mother pretended to be his sister and his grandfather pretended to be his father in order to cover that up in the 1940s and 50s. So, but that, I mean, you know, that's weird and not, you know, probably a bit traumatizing, but wasn't anything to set this off or to have that, have what happened occur. So yeah, there's a lot often we don't see that, you know, they don't see this like clear classic, like, oh, this is schizophrenia that caused him to do this. No, it's usually, it's just like, oh, like it just happened. That's why I think one of the biggest reasons why it's so intriguing is you don't really see it until you see it, or you have them come in for something else. And then you go, oh, this person is not fit to be leaving this hospital sort of thing.
You know, it's interesting. I actually did in medical school, you do 2 months of psychiatry rotation generally. And my 2 months, I was sent to the jail for forensic psychiatry. No one wanted that rotation. To be fair, I was not super stoked about having to spend 2 months in a jail. I got to leave at the end of the day, which was nice. And I learned a ton, and I saw some amazing cases that to this day I have stuck with me for good and definitely for bad. And I remember specifically, I was there and the guards were like, hey, can you do a physical exam on this one guy? And I'm like, oh, sure. Cause, you know, I was a medical student at the time. I probably had the best physical exam skills of any medical professional in that place. Absolutely. So I go into this tiny little room. It's basically like a closet. And I'm a large mammal myself. And the guy who was in the room with me made me feel dainty and small. And normally I like that, but this was not that much fun. Because he was like, I don't know, 6'7", massive monster of a man. But he seemed to have the mind of a child. He kind of giggled and he was like, the stethoscope touched him. He's like, hee-hee-hee. And he was like, seemed completely innocent and sweet, to be honest with you. And when it was done, like I sent him out, and I turned to the officer who was there, and I was like, "What was he in for?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, that guy, he killed his family." And I was like, "What's in the closet with him?"
Annihilation.
But honestly, when I was there with him, I felt like whatever it was gone. I mean, I didn't feel that. I mean, I don't know what there's clearly, he wasn't right. There was some sort of, I don't know what his underlying medical issue or psychological psychiatric issues were, but I never got that sense. It's really fascinating to me.
And I think that's really, you know, a thing that people like sometimes forget when we're talking about these things, is that the nature of mental illness is they're not always there all the time. Right, these delusions, these psychoses, these breaks from reality, it's not a 24/7 thing for a lot of people. They may come in episodes so that people may act a certain way or have a certain break or some behaviors that occur or reactions that may occur. And a lot of the times when people are, again, NGRI is not guilty by reason of insanity, they're not sitting down and planning these things out, right? They don't have the capability, the mental capacity to kind of like, let me become a serial killer, right? There's that aspect where they're serial killers. There's an intelligence level, right? There's a massive amount of mental capacity, a lot of bookkeeping, a lot of ways to like not get caught that goes into it. So when we think about it from that point of view of like, logistically, it's hard to be a serial killer, right? You have to dispose of the body. You have to not get caught. You have to like, you know, clean yourself off, all these things. If you're somebody who's struggling with mental illness and like, you know, having trouble with day-to-day life, like you're not going to be a very good serial killer. And that's why a lot of these people, when, you know, if something were to occur with these people, they get caught really easily. And then that's how they end up in the prison system or the psychiatric state hospital system.
The biggest thing that I think what you just said there too is that with a lot of cases, the police negligence is one of the biggest reasons why we don't catch them right away. Like back in the 70s and 80s when, you know, being a homosexual was like taboo as could be. Killers like John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer, the ones that had victims were mostly boys, young boys, and were obviously being very sexually motivated crimes. The police wouldn't touch those because they were to touch a crime that was, you know, involved homosexuals was to make you a homosexual, and that was not good. We didn't like that, right? Like that. Their mentality was so disgusting towards the LGBTQ community that they just would not investigate these obviously blatant crimes. Like they said that the moment they walked into Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment, it was just the stench of death hit them. Had they done an inkling of, you know, research or, you know, being like, hey, this young boy is running away from us and this guy is chasing after him, maybe we should see what's going on. And they didn't, you know, they didn't. And he continued to kill like two or three more people after that. And a lot of it is this negligence. They miss these well, obvious signs of these people. They're like, oh.
I'm going to ask you guys this question in a moment. But of all the cases that I know, I don't study serial killers in that much depth, but I have seen, you know, some Netflix shows, and I've done. I have my morbid curiosities, just like anyone else. So I'll watch things, but that Dahmer case in particular is really troubling to me, and really. Oh, bothersome. Really can't had a hard time getting past that one. And I went down a rabbit hole to look into it, just to sort of go over again what you were describing there. What happened was one of his victims was a young man, like 14 years old, who he had lured into his place, like with you know, this offer to take pictures of him for money, like a modeling type thing. And he was going to give him money for it. He ended up drugging the kid, drilling a hole into his head to try and do this weird lobotomy thing he was trying to do on some of his victims. He went out to go get beers. He came back and he found that the kid had somehow managed, essentially being naked, to make it out the door, stumbled and fell outside. There were people there in the apartment building. He had called the police. The police had come, and the police had said to, you know, Dahmer, you know, who is this kid? And he was like, oh, he's my lover, which is already weird. I mean, the kid's 14. They don't even recognize that. The kid has blood coming from his rectum, like that the bystanders had noticed. The cops take him back up. They don't do a check on Dahmer. When they do, if they had done a check on Dahmer, they would have found that Dahmer had done prison time for what? For molesting the same kid's older brother. It's fucking insane. And then these kids, just like you, he kills, they give him back this kid because he says it's his lover, and the kid unfortunately dies. What makes the story infuriating to me, even beyond that, is that, yes, these two cops were put on probation for a while, but they were eventually reinstated with full back pay. And one of them, at least if not both of them, went on to have successful police careers, but one of them became like the police union chief for like 10 years. It's the most insane, infuriating thing. And there's so many different stories that bother me. The John Wayne Gacy one really bothers me because he's just mean and he's a bully. And there's something about that really fucking pisses me off. But there's that one of how the police incompetence led to it. It's hard to stomach. What are the ones, what are the ones that bother? I mean, they're all bothersome, but which are the ones you find sit the worst with you, that you guys were thinking about the most afterwards, and it made you the angriest or made you the most upset?
My one I hate the most is Picton, Robert Picton. He's a Canadian serial killer. I want to say he had almost in the 50s. But what his MO was to lure sex workers to his farm, have sex, and then kill them, and then dump their bodies in the pig farm and feed them to the pigs. Which I think is also a Criminal Minds episode too, which is just, one in of itself. But the thing I hate about those, and the same thing with the LGBTQ community and everything like that, is what's the term is the lesser dead. And when it comes to crime, it comes to serial killers, it comes to any of these kind of issues, it's the people that don't notice going missing because they don't care enough to check. And a lot of the time, you don't catch them until there's a gross population missing. You have 50 serial, 50, sex workers missing, and the remaining of that sex worker population is like, we have like lost our friends. Like, where are they gone? And you can't get access to those police officers for that. That's what always upsets me the most is when it's these victims that they don't care about enough to look into.
What about you, Soma?
Yeah, I mean, just going to add on to that is like, the idea that this is something that's throughout American history and human society as a whole too. Like, we talk about, part of what I do is addiction work. The war on drugs and how nobody cared about a lot of these epidemics and the opioids and et cetera until the opioid epidemic, which was hitting mostly suburban rural people more so than urban populations, which like other drug epidemics were causing havoc before, and HIV, AIDS, et cetera. That's it was when Magic Johnson, a rich black person, rich famous black person, it becomes the face of HIV AIDS that people are like, whoa, I got to do something about this. Going back a little bit for, for my, again, favorite psychopath per se, or the one who's most fascinating to me is not a classic serial killer per se, but Jim Jones, the cult
Oh, yeah.
leader in Jonestown. Like I could watch stuff on that endlessly, because it's so fascinating to me that like, for people who are not familiar, this was I think in 1980, I think that it occurred. But he was a essentially a cult leader out in San Francisco, and he created this kind of colony in South America. I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was, and this is where the term "drinking the Kool-Aid" came from. They were going to be, they were getting checked out by some senators, and some reporters came, felt they were under attack at that point in time. And then essentially like overnight or in the next morning decided we're going to do this mass suicide and give everybody some cyanide laced Kool-Aid essentially, or not Kool-Aid, it's Flavor Aid it was,
It was Flavor Aid,
and
yeah.
Flavor Aid. So I think it was 900 something people that died, and I think before up until 9/11 it was the greatest like loss of Americans at one point in time in history. And it was just fascinating that you have this huge group of people that can be so in this cult and believe somebody so much, so deeply that they'd be like, yes, we're gonna drink this and we're gonna go die. Again, some people, it was
Their
against their
will, I
will, but
heard,
like,
yeah.
yeah, but there was enough that were like, this is
Right.
what we're gonna do and this is what we're gonna do.
Yeah,
We're told to do it.
that is fascinating. That is. It's a very different type of killer, and that requires us, I mean, a certain level of, I don't know, charisma, charm. I don't know how you convince
Yeah.
someone, how do you get someone that to that point, but it's
Oh
happened
man.
in multiple times. People have been able to do that. It's a If I had one tenth of that sort of skill, I would be a much more famous podcaster. And I would use it for good. I promise you, I would
Use
use
it
it
for
for
good.
good. All right, so we have one, I have time for one last question for you guys. This is the thing I've been thinking about now a lot is, is it possible to make movies about these people that is not completely offensive to the families? Like, I can't imagine what the families that have experienced loss due to a serial killer have to go through every fucking time there's like a new movie about the person that killed their family member, and oh, it's Zac Efron this week, like that must be fucking insane. I don't, is it possible to do it? I mean, how? I mean, I don't know. That's my question for you.
I think I don't know. I think my thing is the best ones I watch are like, I say Criminal Minds several times now, but Criminal Minds is one of those really good ones where they don't take the specific cases, but they take the idea of what happened in the case. Like almost every episode they have has had like the idea of what happened in the case. They bring it in and then they do, you know, their FBI, you know, BAU, and then they catch the bad guy and they honor the victims of that specific episode. And while it's not the victims of our, you know, our crimes, it doesn't ever step on those victims, on the people that mm-hmm. actually lost life. But it does bring that case in. It gives you that little bit of morbid curiosity. It's real enough that you can go and look it up and be like, oh, that's what real happened. But you still get that justice, I guess, from it too. Because a lot of these guys didn't get, you know, they don't get justice from a lot of these serial killers. They either died by the electric chair, you know, lethal injection. They don't end up usually serving time, at least not recently, because we had death penalty for most of these cases.
Yeah. What are you saying?
I think I was going to say, like, it's really hard because you want to, again, we share the stories, tell the stories a bit, but you want to really kind of emphasize so much, like, how terrible these people are and were. You know, one of the issues, you know, we've seen it in kind of popular fiction, popular world. I've been a very vocal critic of the Joker movie that came out, the Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie, because, you know, Joker, I love Joker as a character throughout, again, the 100-something years that Batman's been there, his portrayals, he is the typical psychopath, right? He is the classical kind of fictional psychopath. He murders on a whim. There's no kind of rhyme or reason to things. The backstory doesn't matter so much for him. He's just there. He's just this agent of chaos. Joker, the one that just came out recently, you know, you tried to build empathy for him. They told the story, so they're like, this is why it occurred, and this is where he's coming from, and we should feel pity, and you should feel justice for it. Like, you should feel like, yeah, he's right. Joker was a good guy. Like, and that's, like, that's one of my main hatred, because I was like, no, Joker is an asshole. He's a terrible person. He's a psychopath. There's no redeeming qualities about him. And we shouldn't be made to feel like I'm rooting for this guy almost. And that's, I think, where some of the issues kind of recently, I stayed away from the Netflix Dahmer fictionalization, because I didn't want to watch it. I wasn't interested in watching it, because I heard so much of the negative feedback to it. Was like, they played up, I think I saw like some clips on Twitter of people who were, of some of the scenes where they kind of reacted out the courtroom scenes, like, and then the news footage, almost like verbatim essentially. And it's like, how terrible must that be to have your life as a family of the victim kind of like played for entertainment and not for a sense of, you know, something else that's there. And so it's that balance of being like, tell the story, reemphasize that the guy's terrible and there's no redeeming qualities and we don't want to root for him at all.
You know, I have to tell you, so I watched that whole series. I don't typically watch them, but that's one I watched the whole series of, and you're exactly right. What they started off with is the first episode, you're like, oh, this guy is fucking evil. And then they go into like this whole like couple episodes where you're supposed to like feel for him. And then at the end, they bring in John Wayne Gacy to be almost as if to be like, look, this is what a real asshole is like. And you're like, no, this guy, they're both really fucking bad. They're both really bad. It was hard. It was hard in that sense to watch. Also, it's like you when you have an actor that you like playing the guy, it's hard to not kind of like him. But I mean, I don't know what there is to be done about that. But all right. That was a pretty heavy episode, and I think you guys helped me navigate it very well. Thank you guys so much for coming on for this one. This was not an easy one, but really fascinating. Yeah. And I think you guys both have tremendous insight into this. Let me get your plugs, because I do want people to know where to find you. Bone, where can people find you?
Primarily on Twitter, because I, as much as it is going down in flames, I am sticking around for the end times, @_bonewizard. So it's spelled the way it sounds. And if you can't find it, then just look for Kaveh's, you know, Twitter, and I'm probably there, or Ryan Marino, or any of the other regulars. John Cena follows me. Now I get bots following me. Yeah, I get bots now. I get a lot of bots following me because of John Cena. I blame him for it.
Listen, man, if John Cena, if you can get this episode out to John Cena, then I'm done. That's it. That's all I needed. If I could get John Cena to listen to this one, that would be it for me. Soma, where can people find you?
Yeah, so I primarily came up in the past year plus about doing some, got into this whole TikTok business about, through a buddy of mine who lost his job through the pandemic, non-medical stuff, but he was like, oh, he's a British guy. He's like, oh, you should really get into this. And now he's making a career out of, you know, narrating true crime stories on YouTube, essentially. Mm-hmm. So speaking of which, you know, this is all right up his alley, and I'll make sure that he gives us a listen for sure. But I am the Kix Shrink, T-H-E, and then Kix, K-I-C-K-S, and then Shrink, S-H-R-I-N-K, because I love sneakers. I love psychiatry, and I try to blend the two together. I do a lot of what I call edutainment, a lot of satirical stuff about poking fun of at psychiatrists, poking fun at the healthcare industry as a whole. So a lot of the stuff, you know, I have a lot of inspiration from Dr. Glockenfecken. He's a hero of mine in a way. I'm the psychiatric version of him, some people have said. So we try to do some stuff and put some things out there. And then TikTok, Instagram, I have a YouTube channel as well. We do some more educational stuff on there. And then I do my own kind of podcast interviews as well. On there as well. So that's mostly, and then my Twitter is Soul Money. I've had my Twitter account around for 15 years since it's all started out. And it was my nickname at the time, and still it's been there for a long time. So SUL, right. And then money.
But yep. Does Dr. G follow you though? That's the real question.
You know, unfortunately he does not. You know, one day I check every day. I wake up in the morning, I was like, is he following me yet? And then it sets a tone for the day when I don't.
I also check every day to make sure it wasn't an accident when he did follow me. Yeah. I don't know why, but just check every day anyways.
No, it's true. He followed me and my whole life changed. Everything. That's all you need to be happy. That's all you need.
It is. I know Big Pharma tells you like you need some other stuff, but I said, hey, if Dr. Glock, Dr. She can follow me, I'll be cured.
You're good to go. Well, here's to hoping. We'll tag him in this maybe. All right. Thank you guys all so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And thank you to Nadine for help with production. You can follow me on Twitter if you want at the House of Pod. I don't know. See how long I'm on there for. And you can find me at Mastodon, maybe, and if not there, Instagram. Or, I don't know, just listen to the show. I mean, come on, just listen to the show. It's better than the me tweeting anyways. Thanks, guys. See you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.